Hello and welcome to Twin Features, a film podcast in which we will suggest to you a double or twin feature of films that might not seem immediately obvious, but with deeper analysis come to highlight a connection related to an area of film and filmmaking that we find particularly interesting. I'm Alex Brindle, I'm a film studies teacher.
And I'm Lewis Brindle, Alex's twin brother and an assistant director working in film and TV.
This week, our focus is on stardom and the star presence in The Third Man and Pale Rider.
Vienna, 1950. A city fearful of its present, uncertain of its future. Here in the shadows of its palaces and ruins is told with tenderness, drama, and suspense the story of The Third Man.
There was a third man there. I suppose that doesn't sound peculiar to you.
I'm not interested in whether a racketeer like Lyme was killed by his friends or by an accident. The only important thing is that he's dead.
Joseph Cotten in his most successful performance as an American caught in a whirlpool of continental intrigue. The glamorous Valley is the mysterious Viennese actress who knew the secret of The Third Man.
The Third Man, 1949, directed by Carol Reed, written by Graham Greene, set in Vienna in the aftermath of the Second World War, follows Holly Martins, played by Joseph Cotten, who's an American writer, arrives in Vienna after being invited by his friend Harry Lime, only to be told that Lime is dead, which is an intriguing little setup. Martins, fancying himself as pragmatic as the pulp Western heroes that he writes about, then tries to unpack the mystery of his friend's death in large quotation marks. And as we're looking at stardom in this episode, the star we want to focus on from The Third Man is the dead man himself, Orson Welles. Now, Orson Welles, ridiculously prolific in theatre, radio, acting and directing before foraying into cinema. His first finished film project, which is an important distinction for Welles, was Citizen Kane in 1941. At the time, a bit of a box office bomb, but lauded by critics. And I think that's one of those films that people want to think people trashed at the time. They didn't really. Critics still really loved it at the time. Followed that up with The Magnificent Ambersons in 1942, which is well known to have been completely gutted by the studio, so much so that, like, who knows what's really left of Welles' vision in the version that we see now. But regardless of that, still another critical success. Yeah, another box office disappointment, though. Next directorial effort, though, would be The Stranger in 1946. This time, both a critical and box office hit. All the while in the 40s, while he was making these films, still constantly active in theatre and radio. It's a miracle any of his projects were actually ever completed. Never mind have the reputation that they do. But this is just all to paint a picture of someone who was sort of larger than life in terms of his presence in the cultural media landscape in the 30s and 40s. Behind the scenes, he earned a reputation as an innovator and also a bit of an agitator. Never willingly prone to compromise, and through his film work he had carved out a really distinctive cinematic style. And then in 1949 he's cast alongside his friend and frequent collaborator Joseph Cotten as the enigmatic centrepiece of The Third Man.
They came out of the mountains to ravage a small mining village. Suddenly, a stranger appeared. And hell followed with him. Some called him preacher. Others called him gunfighter. Clint Eastwood, Pale Rider.
The 1985 Western Pale Rider, starring and directed by Clint Eastwood, written by Michael Butler and Dennis Shriak. I'm probably butchering that name. Eastwood's the mysterious preacher who protects this kind of humble Prospector Village in, I won't say it's in, yeah, in Carbon Canyon,
yeah,
California, protecting the village from this kind of like greedy mining company, you know, standard Western affair. But quick rundown of Eastwood, like you just gave of Wells, started out in the TV series Rawhide, kind of burst onto the scene in cinema with Sergio Leone's spaghetti westerns as the man with no name, the kind of like Western gunslinger, or non-verbal gunman, if you will, in those amazing spaghetti westerns, Fistful of Dollars for a Few Dollars More and The Good, the Bad and the Ugly.
Yeah.
And then obviously he works with directors like Don Siegel on both westerns and other American films like Dirty Harry to become this kind of titan of American cinema before he would then obviously become an auteur himself with a lot of westerns like High Plains Drifter and Pale Rider and Unforgiven being probably the most notable three.
All different decades as well.
All different decades. 70s,
80s, 90s.
70s, 80s, 90s. All three amazing films. We're talking about someone who's making revisionist westerns here. You know, there's much more ambiguity than there was with someone like John Wayne, for instance, if you're going to compare the two as kind of the, I suppose, the men of the West, if you will, in cinema would be Ford, Leone, Eastwood, and Wayne. And you're looking at Ford and Wayne as kind of these more conservative values in the films, but also kind of a more conservative approach to filmmaking in terms of the westerns that they were making being traditional westerns. And then you've got Leone's twist on them, and then Eastwood's own stardom and in him as a filmmaker, his twist on those westerns as well, as I said, being a lot more revisionist, kind of being a lot more ambiguous and often a lot more cynical in some ways of kind of the western hero and the kind of gunman. But obviously Clint Eastwood, a filmmaker and a star, won a bunch of Oscars, not just obviously for westerns, but you're talking about what he's done, Million Dollar Baby, Mystic River was an Eastwood film as well, wasn't it? American Sniper, Sully, loads and loads of films across the years, and he's still making films now. But I think it's that idea of Eastwood as a everlasting kind of star and, I suppose, just structure in American cinematic history, which I still find fascinating, which admittedly we don't see much anymore. He's not much of a performer anymore. And I'm always more fascinated by Eastwood as a performer, and we can couple that up with his directing, like we're going to talk about in Pale Rider. But this guy with this screen presence of it, like you were saying with Orson Welles, that's so captivating that I don't think he get much anymore. And he's too old to maybe have that now on the screen, and he's still, as we saw with Jura 2, which I've not actually seen yet, but, you know, great reviews across the board. So clearly someone who can still make really good kind of films that need to be watched in the cinema, but as kind of like a star and sometimes a subversive star as well. That's what I think I want to talk about in this podcast, in this episode, because like you just said of Orson Welles, Lou, I think Eastwood's understanding of his own screen presence in Pale Rider is really something to watch the film for.
Yeah. Well, like I said, you've sort of keyed into the thesis of this episode, really, which is what we want to focus on. How both films use stardom and the idea of star power of Wells and Eastwood in interesting and similar ways, really. I mean, kicking off the idea of stars, sort of established with Richard Dyer and his book Stars, that, which is a very foundational and quite general idea of the concepts that pretty much everybody knows widespread now. Like, if you're a general moviegoer and you know the idea of a movie star, that sort of stuff is what Richard Dyer's talking about.
Because obviously you had the most, I suppose, influential cinematic movement in history is classic Hollywood cinema.
Yeah.
You know, you still see it everywhere now in ways that we take for granted, just like films being edited in a continuity editing style, you know, giving the kind of depiction of the real passing of time. The way that we consume films now in the mainstream is because of that classic Hollywood filmmaking style. And part of that was the star system and the kind of network and studios full of stars that sold these movies. And obviously Dyer's work years later, kind of reflecting on that and kind of judging the power of these stars themselves. Because obviously at the time, the power was with the producer and stars were there. They were there for hire for these films. Directors were there for hire as well. But as you'll see, along with, you know, Dyer's Ryan, all kind of film scholarship that's coming around in the 60s and 70s, there's a retrospective looking back at these things, and there's a retrospective looking back at some of these directors, like, you know, Howard Hawks and Michael Curtis, mm-hmm. but there's also a retrospective looking back at the stars and the power that they actually held in terms of, you know, this is a money-making business, and the producers might have as much power and money as they want, but these films and these studios are nothing without the stars.
Yeah.
So I think that's probably what, that's what Dyer's tapping into with his study on stars.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. And a concept that I want to really key in on in terms of these two films is in a segment where he mentions stars and character, and he says how audience foreknowledge of a particular star can signify a condensation of attitudes and values associated with them. So basically, how seeing a particular actor can give you a predetermined idea of the sort of character yeah. they're depicting, and how a certain star's image can be used in the construction of a character. Now, I think that's undeniable in Pale Rider with Eastwood. You've just said he made his name really with them as the man with no name.
Yeah.
So you have Eastwood coming in Pale Rider as the preacher.
Yeah.
He doesn't have to... I think it's fascinating in that film. He doesn't have to explain who he is. He doesn't have to say anything, because you already know he's going to be tough, stoic, heroic, effective with a gun, etc.
When I was watching it on my most recent rewatch in preparation for this podcast, it struck me of how minimalist some of necessarily the filmmaking, but the actions of his character were.
Very.
You don't see him riding into town, he's there.
He's there.
You don't see him approach kind of let's call them the baddies, the bad guys, in the kind of deserted saloon town. He just appears at the end of the street.
I know,
he kind of cut all that, all the kind of additional stuff. Obviously, there's relationships built throughout the film, but we're talking about these Western set pieces.
Yeah.
It's minimalist. He cuts it all out, and he's there. You know why he's going to be there.
Yeah, exactly.
You know where he's probably going to be.
Exactly. Yeah. So that audience foreknowledge.
Yeah.
This is 1985 we're talking about here with Pale Rider. So that audience foreknowledge is the foreknowledge that Eastwood is this Western icon.
Yeah.
So you sort of accept that he can do all of these things and stuff like that. And then with the third man, Harry Lime appears to be larger than life, ever present, always talked about and in the spotlight. Hard to put in a singular box, and in many ways very enigmatic and wholly an individual. I could have been describing Orson Welles.
I was about to say that.
I could have been describing Orson Welles, really.
I was about to say, you know, there's that kind of meta-textual thing going on there, where you could have been describing Welles there, and Welles' own kind of passion for magic, and kind of like this real-life magician kind of as one of his hobbies, but also his screen presence in a lot of his films, and particularly this one, is kind of like the dead man who you see.
Yeah.
And obviously, we'll get into speaking about it, but just the amazing introduction.
Well, we can talk about the reveals now, because I thought I think it works better, because you see Eastwood as the preacher when he's emerging from the mountains about 10, 15 minutes into
the Pale Rider. And it's like, where does he come from? But just that
exactly.
He doesn't really matter.
You just get some vague sort of spiritual when Megan, the girl, is praying, and you get this sort of thunder and lightning. Yeah. It's very biblical.
Yeah. Yeah. But also this idea that it doesn't matter where Eastwood's come from. Clearly, you're evoking these kind of films like Shane, the kind of prototypical Western gunslinger, man of kind of the wilderness, who is a mythical figure. He shows up, he helps the town, and then he leaves. And that's kind of similar in High Plains Drifter. I won't give anything away, but I mean, amazing ending to High Plains Drifter, very cynical one compared to like your ending of like Shane or something like that, or even the ending of this film. But yeah, so obviously you were saying about how so kind of comes just from the wilderness.
Just from the wilderness down from the mountain. But I thought
that someone wills him into existence.
Exactly, And the reveal of these characters isn't necessarily when we first see him, because we see Harry Lime for a great shot that sort of... It's really out of the blue in The Third Man, when you've got Martin's in an apartment, and then the camera just sort of cuts to this sort of shot that dollies forward through some flowers on a windowsill, and we see like a figure in an alleyway, in like a doorway. But I think the reveal of the characters is much stronger. I put it as when other characters first see them, which is in the third man. That's when you get that great shot of Orson Welles, the close up when the light's sort of coming on and off, and we see sort of half his face, and he's got like a wry smile, smirking.
Yeah, there's something we said about the black cat that's hanging around him as well. This kind of idea,
And then the first time that someone sees the preacher in Pale Rider is what you're saying, when they see him at the edge of town, and he's just there on his horse, on his pale horse, and he just appeared. I don't know, and that's just too amazing.
Well, he kind of, someone mentions the pale horse, and then he kind of comes into frame.
Yeah.
From a window next to the person who's speaking, and obviously these notions of like death, or mortality, what both films are kind of dealing with these characters, because obviously Pale Rider, the pale horse, being like a symbol, a biblical symbol of death, but also throughout the film, I just thought throughout the third man, what Orson Welles was, particularly there's a long lingering shot where Joseph Cotton's character is kind of sat on the Ferris wheel, and you see him walking, but he's wearing like all black, and his coat's really long, and it's so boxy that he's such like a impending and I suppose a devastating image, just because he's so big in the frame, and it's this beautiful black and white cinematography, and it's a really bright day, but this just kind of like block of kind of black colour coming towards.
And that's sort of backed by the soundtrack as well, the Anton Karas's zither soundtrack, which is the instrument that he uses, which he sort of like plucks away at constantly through the soundtrack, which is just great. But yeah, I mean, I guess this, I think we first spoke about these two films in this context because I remember you mentioning them and saying how these characters loom over each film, and that's so true narratively. I mean, in the world of the film, neither Eastwood or Welles are a constant presence, like the physical presence, I should say. I mean, Harry Lime doesn't appear until like nearly an hour into the film. And Eastwood's preacher sort of seems to appear like a ghost, you know, at every perfect moment, scene to scene, but he sort of just hovers in and out of each scene and stuff. You know, what are the character's exact origins? In the third man, that is the real debate, and so is the preachers in Pale Rider. Like, you don't really know where these people have come from and what they're doing. Yet the presence is always felt. Characters are constantly talking about them, trying to unwrap the enigma. So I think you don't get that same effect if that isn't Welles, if that isn't Eastwood.
Well, yeah, that's what we're saying. Not only that these characters loom over these films and these narratives, but it's because of the stars that play them.
Exactly.
And, you know, because the spectator, their expectations for this film and for this star and this character are transferred onto a film even before they start watching it. So it's the idea of playing with those expectations. And in terms of Pearl Rider, a big kind of influence for me for wanting to do this episode was Roger Ebert's initial review of the film in, I believe it was the Chicago Sun, the Chicago Times. One of the Chicago newspaper.
Yeah.
Where he talks about this idea of, you know, Eastwood conveying these emotions or conveying, I suppose, anything his character wants to say with the slightest kind of suggestion, the slightest gesture, the slightest look. But this idea that at the time, Ebert says, no actor was more aware of their own instruments. And that's where you get this idea of there was no one better to direct Eastwood than Eastwood himself. You know, he dominates the film, yet you don't see him that much, really, if you go back. Because in context of him being the central figure of the film, you don't actually see him that much. But he fills each scene with his own image and his own dialogue. Ebert says,
well, that's it. Like, you have the actual characters in the town that he's protecting, who are the ones who have the development, who have the stories and amongst themselves and stuff like that. And Eastwood just sort of is this character that comes in and sort of answers a lot of the prayers that they're asking for and stuff like that. I know that William Friedkin said in an interview, said something similar about The Third Man. about how Wells is such a presence, how he just looms over. I mean, the intrigue and the reveal in The Third Man aren't the same if it isn't Wells. You see Orson Welles' name on the poster, you're thinking, right, where is he? Is this him? Is that him? Like your concert. So that's when that reveal does come. It's exciting. You sort of sit up in your seat a bit. You're like, all right, he is here. And then in Pale Rider, because it's Eastwood, as you say, you just believe everything that this preacher is doing and saying. And you just believe he this lot, like the antagonist in Pale Rider. They're all really scared of him. They think they know him from somewhere or something like that. It's like, well, you know. If you want to speak of it from a metatextual point of view, it's like, well, it's because it's Clint Eastwood. That's why you're scared of him.
Well, exactly, I mean, Ebert says that Eastwood uses like a sleight of hand where we're shown his eyes, a corner of his mouth, or his face in a shadow, his figure with kind of strong light behind it, all evoking this idea of maybe Eastwood's character, spoilers coming up, maybe Eastwood's character's a ghost, maybe he's a dead man, which is also what links these two films. But, you know, many great westerns grew out of the director's profound understanding of the screen presence of their actor, is another thing Ebert says. Think about the relationship between Ford and
John Wayne
or Ford and Henry Fonda, or Howard Hawks and John Wayne, you know, that relationship, these directors who know how to use the screen presence of their star. Well, Eastwood understands himself how his own kind of screen presence works and the power of that. And it's because of his stardom, if you ask me, you know, the unique impact that Eastwood brings to this role as a performer. He knows that no one else could play this role. But, you know, getting to that idea of this ghostly figure turning up, and you're never given answers, but it's very ambiguous, you know. I mean, maybe you want to say when he kind of has the final showdown and the kind of the leader of the posse recognizes Eastwood. But before then, he said to LaHood, the main bad guy, no, it can't be. It sounds like you're describing this guy, but you can't be that guy because that guy's dead. And then there's this look of just kind of like fear and disbelief on his face when he actually sees Eastwood. But it's that he moves around the town. If we're just speaking about the climax of Pale Rider, first of all, don't you think he moves around the town like a ghost, picking all those people off? And like he gets off the horse with all these gunmen looking at him, and obviously they can't really see his face yet, but he just kind of calmly walks, and he's walking in between the buildings. He moves, and he kind of, he's at one side of the town, and then he's at the other side of the town.
That's it. And I think that mysticism around the character, you certainly get in the first two-thirds of A Third Man as well with Wells. And then where these films do differ is in that last third, you do get this sort of tearing down of who the characters, certainly who Holly Martins thought his friend was and stuff like that. But yeah, like you alluded to before, the looming presence of the characters also transfers over to the looming presence of the stars. With A Third Man, I mean, there's a really good book by Jonathan Rosenbaum called Discovering Orson Welles, and this is something that Peter Bogdanovich, filmmaker and film historian, mentions about how Reed and Green, the director and writers of A Third Man, consciously or not, do borrow a lot of Wellesian themes and stylistic choices. I mean, the Dutch angles, the eye-popping use of shadows and silhouettes, that focus on a betrayal of friendship, which is a motif that is so on the nose for this film. You have to think it was purposefully self-referential, because casting Wells alongside his friend Joseph Cotten, who had worked together previously on Magnificent Ambersons, Journey into Fear, but had also played friends alienated from each other in Citizen Kane. You know what I mean? Like, you don't, that surely has to be a purposeful nod.
And it's easy to forget that watching these films now and not being alive when these films came out.
Because
clearly when these films came out, that would have been essential. Exactly.
That these are two characters, you know, like, why do you cast, you know, De Niro and Joe Pesci in The Irishman again, if you might Scorsese? It's because the audience knows these are the old characters who used to cast, and then we're reliving that in a different context. But yeah, that just adds more context and more audience foreknowledge, sort of enhancing the relationships that you know about between these characters. But I mean, you get the sense that Wells's role in A Third Man reaches far beyond just acting in it. Again, Rosenbaum in his book talks about the rumours and misconceptions that Wells actually directed The Third Man, or at least had several, you know, had hands in several scenes, which is a theory that has been suggested about pretty much every one of the films that Orson Welles acted in but didn't direct. I mean, Wells himself, whether purposefully or not, fueled this by years later reprising Harry Lime in radio shows that he helped write as well. Yeah. So he's sort of, whether I have a suspicion that that's purposeful on Orson Welles' behalf, because he's like, well, people think I was the author of this text. Yeah. Well, I'm going to revise it myself and, you know, stuff like that. Yeah. But, I mean, that it has a theory that has been debunked in the case of them. And Welles did provide some lines for Lime, notably the famous cuckoo clock line. But yeah, that has been debunked by several people who worked on the film. But this is the level of star we're talking about with Orson Welles. Like, not only do people think he directed it, like, his shadow is that large over the production that you can't help but draw comparisons to his own work. And subsequently, you can't help but think, well, surely he had a hand in all of this. I mean, I guess it's a bit simpler when you look at Pale Rider when...
Well, maybe that's the main difference between these two stars, maybe because there's a much clearer distinction between the Pale Rider, the non-verbal gunslinger, the man with no name, and Clint Eastwood versus Harry Lime and Orson Welles. There's not as clear a distinction there, where there's one star and one end, kind of, in the personality-wise, because, I mean, of course, Eastwood, revisionist Western filmmaker, a lot of kind of self-doubt and ambiguity and questioning of his own character in these films leads to questioning of the genre itself. But realistically, if we're talking visually as well, the Western genre doesn't really change. You've still got the same iconography throughout from kind of your very early Westerns to your Westerns even being made now. That's how we know it's a Western. But the Eastwood character is so ingrained in that, and kind of even was by 85, you know, you're talking 20 years or so Fistful of Dollars. So he's able to kind of work with this persona in kind of a way that's maybe a bit minimalist, but also is very mysterious and often otherworldly in terms of the imagery and in terms of work. As we said, this character keeps popping up. But you're never necessarily under the illusion that's anything other than this character that Eastwood's playing. Yeah. I suppose the looming kind of
shadow
of Welles himself over that film, it's not necessarily a looming shadow of Eastwood over this film, but it's a looming shadow of the gunslinger that he plays.
That's it. Yeah.
Which, you know, he's still using that star persona of his. But, I mean, Eastwood's an actor who is maybe his most iconic role is as Dirty Harry, which isn't a Western, not a typical Western star. You know, I'm sure there's debates to be had of how much of a kind of gunslinger Dirty Harry really is. You know, and I've got no doubt that when Eastwood and Don Siegel were making Dirty Harry, this idea of Eastwood already established cinematically as this gunslinger helped kind of with that, the intimidating nature of that character and kind of the forceful nature of that character. But yeah, I mean, I think whereas in The Third Man, it's so fun.
Mm.
I mean, they're both so fun. At the end of the day, what I get out of these films and the use of stardom in both of these cases, it's really fun to
it's
see.
It's a joy. It's like you're giggling when they turn up.
Because you don't see anymore this idea of stardom being used as a shorthand for storytelling,
narrative storytelling.
And I'm not talking about a wink to the camera kind of thing, that kind of that metatextual thing, because, you know, this is an
actor playing the fourth wall.
I'm not talking about the breaking the fourth wall. I'm talking about, as Ebert said in his review, actors who know their own instruments and can use them and can kind of often give the audience what they want to see, but also subvert what the audience wants to see. And it's a really fun, particularly in Pale Rider, it's just really fun to, it kind of scratches an itch when you want to just watch a really good Western. It scratches an itch because it Eastwood knows what he's doing. It knows what you want to see with this character. He's not reinventing the wheel with the story that you're seeing.
No, no.
But he's putting his own twist on it. And whereas older films like Shane, for instance, as I've just mentioned, have this kind of mythical edge to it. You know, where did this wanderer come from?
Yeah.
Why is he helping these people? Yeah. Eastwood kind of takes that to a whole new level. And maybe this person is a ghost, actually.
Yeah.
Maybe this is kind of a relic of the West. And maybe this, you know, maybe this is really what we're grappling with here. This idea of obviously right and wrong, but maybe the, you know, they need to summon kind of,
yeah.
They essentially summon the death.
He's like one of the four horsemen of the apocalypse, really, isn't he?
Yeah.
On his pale horse.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think with the third man, with Wells, like you mentioned about the old Hollywood, he does hearken back to that, because in an interview with Peter Bogdanovich, Wells actually said the old star actors never liked to come out until the end of the first act, which is Harry Lime. Like, and he also mentioned the idea that the star role is the one that the characters talk about the most. The one that's spectated over, that drives intrigue. And certainly The Preacher and certainly Harry Lime fit that category in these films.
But also the characters within the films are just as enamoured with these characters as we are.
You think about how
kind of in love with Harry Lime and in love with The Preacher, the characters in the film often become either in love with or obsessed with the characters.
Yeah.
You know, that's another thing the filmmakers clearly do to get the point across, that there's something special about these characters. There's something that's making people gravitate towards these characters. Mm. And even in Pale Rider, it's at the, I suppose, detriment of the other male characters in the film, because this guy comes along and suddenly no one else is kind of good enough.
Especially Hull.
Yeah.
Who's like perfectly nice.
But next to Eastwood.
So emasculated.
Yeah.
Because Eastwood comes in and he's taller than him.
Yeah.
And his hair looks great. And he's
galvanizing all these people to fight. But then you also realise that when you take Eastwood away, because, you know, they all vote to reject Lud's offer and kind of stand up. But they only did that because they thought Eastwood was going to be there.
I also think it's fun how, like, you see him, he's a badass, he looks cool, he's just beat all these people up. Oh, and he's a man of the cloth as well.
Yeah.
He's like, especially in the context of the time that it's set.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, right, so this guy.
Well, and there's the great shot of him kind of getting rid of his the kind of collar and swapping it for the gun.
That's really fun, really good. Yeah, I thought that we've talked about the use of shadows and silhouettes in The Third Man, but I did think it was similar in Pale Rider as well. Both films have scenes have settings that are very dark. I think it's quite opposite though, because in A Third Man it's the outside that's all covered in shadow. It's Vienna, post-war Vienna, that's covered in the shadows and stuff like that. And in Pale Rider I thought the interiors were so dark, purposefully dark, whereas everyone seemed like a silhouette. It really invoked that shot in The Searchers where it opens up to the vast expanse of the West from the inside, and I just thought that was quite interesting in Pale Rider, how the whole interiors are really sort of dark, quite candlelit, and the outside is always shining and bright, and
against the snow as well.
Yeah,
I mean, it's quite like, you know, it's against the snow, and like you're saying, again, I suppose it goes to the director in this case, Eastwood's kind of understanding and trusting of the audience to not give them the answers to everything, even narratively or visually.
Yeah.
You're hiding some things in the dark.
Yeah.
Because, as we've mentioned, this is 85. You know, we've had decades of Westerns now, and Eastwood is a revisionist Western filmmaker. He's commenting on the Western, and he's using his visual kind of filmmaking, his visual storytelling, as a shorthand for the audience, be it through, as we're saying, kind of the not giving the audience all the answers visually or narratively, because he wants them to make up their own mind. But the point of these films is that they're more ambiguous, and obviously that's maybe shown quite overtly in The Darkness used. And in the Third Man, I think it really emphasises the footsteps. When they're running.
So loud. Yeah. In the sewers, but also just up above on the cobbles. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. They're well loud. I mean, just to bring you back to the point you were talking about Eastwood, about his character being so perfect, quite emasculate. I mean, you get that from Harry Lime as well. Like, if you think about Holly Martin's, his friend, he's sort of that stereotypical noir hero who doesn't really do much. He can't really do much. He's I mean, certainly when he tries to spark a relationship with Anna, who is still grieving over Wells, he's sort of shot down. He sort of seems quite pathetic, which is, again, quite a bit of a trope in noir. You see it in also, especially neo-noir films, you know, like The Big Lebowski and stuff like that, where these characters who, not for want of trying, but everything they try and do is just a fool's errand and something. You get that with Martins as well. And I just love Trevor Howard in The Third Man as Calloway, who's just that straight talking.
Yeah,
he's great. He's fantastic.
Yeah.
But you're just keen into it, like how this use of stardom as how did you word it? Like the use of stardom in these films.
It's a shorthand.
Yeah.
And you don't. Maybe we should end by kind of having a conversation about why you don't see much of this anymore. Maybe it's coincided with kind of the decline of the movie star, and I'm not talking about actors, famous actors, I'm talking about movie stars.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
Because I don't think you get, and you know, I hate sounding like someone who's like, you know, that, you know, because they do still make amazing films, and there is still amazing actors, but movie stars like Wells, like Eastwood, that were often larger than the films that they were making, and as we've hopefully just somewhat explained, actually were so vital in the conveying of messages in these films, whether it's kind of the idea of individual versus or with the kind of collective, or this kind of critique of capitalism, or this idea of justice and morality, and the questioning of the myth of the American West in Pale Rider. It's all there through Eastwood's knowledge of the genre, but he's also kind of playing with the star and his star persona and this character that he's played before in different kind of iterations, but never like this.
Never like this.
Never as mysterious as this.
Yeah.
Never as kind of, I suppose, fused with mystery as in this film. You don't see that anymore, I don't think.
No. And I think, I think certainly when you look back at the stars of the past, the Eastwood, Wayne, Wells, I think you get this with this very, I mean, a film that we could have spoken about, I think, that could have been substituted in for this is Apocalypse Now, with Marlon Brando. With the whole, I mean, there's certainly similar themes, incredibly similar themes to The Third Man in Apocalypse Now with Kurtz and with Lime. I mean, even looking contextually, like, it's been noted that Wells was influenced by Joseph Conrad, who wrote Heart of Darkness, which is what Apocalypse Now is based on. Even to the point that one of Wells' first unfinished films before Citizen Kane was an adaptation of Heart of Darkness. So you do have that thing there, and so I think that's just quite an interesting through line to another film that does utilise that star power in Marlon Brando.
But again, we're talking about a star which you would...
Larger than life.
You would class Brando as one of those older movie stars who, again, don't really make them like that anymore. And I do think, like I mentioned before, I do think Eastwood's a little bit different. I think with Pale Rider and with Eastwood's Western films, it's him playing with the character trope that he's been known for, rather than... But that is so linked to his stardom, I suppose.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Two really good films. The more I sort of looked into both of them in this context, the more I loved how they did go together. When you're looking at the stardom.
But structurally as well, how much you see both of the characters. Obviously, they're introduced at different times, but what they mean and what their appearances mean for the narrative and for the films, and kind of, like you're saying, this idea of the looming presence of both characters and how that affects everyone else. And I didn't even really realise it until we just spoke then, particularly how it affects the other male characters in the films. It's really similar.
It is. These films aren't the same without these two stars in them, which I think is key to what we're talking about.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. And hopefully you enjoyed listening to us ramble with, you know, film theory and scholarship backing it up, but still rambling nevertheless, about two films that we really like and that we have just linked together. Because if you did like it, then hopefully you'll want to listen to more of it. And we're hopefully going to be able to produce more of these little episodes. We're not sure how frequent they're going to be, but produce more of these twin features where we both think of a film or think of these films together that you might not immediately think on the surface just looking at the titles, how are these films linked, but we're just going to hopefully present to you a way in which we think they're linked and which maybe enriches your viewing of both of the films together. And again, two films that you might never thought of viewing together, but in this case of The Third Man and Pale Rider, I really think if you do view these films together and you have that idea of the star and stardom in your mind, then it's going to be a really enjoyable watch, and it's also going to kind of open your eyes up to what someone's star presence can do as well. And that's what we want to do. We want to give maybe like a little bit of a different perspective on films, but also at the same time, recommending films that we really love as well, Lou. Would you agree?
Yeah, 100%. Yes. And these are two films that, I think are really good places to look at from a noir perspective, from a revisionist Western perspective.
Links to all of the kind of sources that we use to research some of the quotes and some of the scholarship and the writing on these films, that will be in the description. Even ones that we've not maybe mentioned by name or not really used, just kind of like some extra reading around this area, because as we mentioned before, it is a really kind of interesting area and a really unique area to film as well, this idea of stardom, which is a really kind of fun one to read around. And especially if you've got like a favourite older movie star, a movie star from the classic era as well, there's going to be a load of writing on them. If you've got a favourite actor who's, I don't know, a Chris Evans, one of the Hollywood Chrises, I don't know if there's going to be much writing on them. But maybe we should do an episode on one of the Hollywood Chrises, Lou.
Maybe. Not the next one.
Not the next one, though. Yeah, but maybe sometime. Yeah. But yes, thank you very much for listening.
Cheers, thank you.
See ya.
Goodbye.